The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo.
Here.
Berger.
Here.
Blake excused. Blickery.
Here.
Bonner.
Here.
Botten.
Here.
Brechtel.
Here.
Brechtel. Brown.
Here.
Burkhart.
Here.
Bird.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Kennedy.
Here.
Childers.
Here.
Connolly. Connolly. Kraft.
Here.
Davison.
Here.
Edmonds,
here.
Eklund,
here.
Esquivel,
here.
Freeman,
here.
Gay,
here.
Gingery, Gingery, Goggles,
here.
Greer,
here.
Green,
here.
Harshman,
here.
Harvey,
here.
Hunt,
here.
Illaway,
here.
Yagi,
here.
Kasparik,
here.
Croker,
here.
Crone,
here.
Lockhart,
here.
Laux,
here.
Lubno,
here.
Madden,
here.
McKim,
here.
McComey,
here.
Miller,
here.
Moniz,
here.
Nicholas,
here.
Patton,
here.
Peasley,
here.
Pedersen,
here.
Peterson,
here.
Petroff, Korberg,
here.
Reeder,
here.
Roscoe,
here.
Semlich,
here.
Stewart,
here.
Stubson,
here.
Teeters,
here.
Throne,
here.
Vronish,
here.
Wallace,
here.
Zwanitzer Dan,
here.
Zwanitzer Dave,
here.
Mr. Speaker,
here.
Brechtel, Connolly.
Here.
59 present, 1 excused.
Please stand and join in the morning prayer with Father George Garlos.
Mr. Speaker, thank you again for the honor of being here this week. It has been a blessing, and I look forward to following the wonderful work that you all continue. Gracious God, we come to you in prayer, inviting your blessing upon those who serve our great state. We thank you for the worthy men and women of this house and ask that you grant each member your wisdom and strengthen them. Continue to inspire their discernment and guide their decisions. As we look back on our predecessors who served this state, we can say, well done. As future generations look back over the work being done here, let them be able to say, well done, knowing that we have served to the best of our abilities on behalf of the people of Wyoming. As we travel this weekend, we ask that you remain with us and our loved ones. Bless and guide our hands and our minds that we may safely return to our peaceful pursuits. And that when we return, being rested and renewed, grant that we may continue our service in this house on behalf of the people of this great state. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
At that order of business, Journal Committee report.
Mr. Speaker, your Journal Committee reports that the Journal of February 23rd, 2012 has been read and recommends that it be approved. Signed, Representative Kasparek, Representative Freeman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to introduce you to a historic American born on the 4th of July, July 4th, 1999. the most senior guest page of the day, starting on the second day of the program. My son, our guest page, sitting up in front of the speaker's desk, Thomas Edwin Lubnow III.
Welcome to the House once again. Representative Crone.
Mr. Speaker, privilege of the floor, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. It's a great honor for me to welcome some folks down from Cody, Park County, two number ones on your Wyoming license plate, as we mentioned before. It's great to have the mayor of the city of Cody, Nancy Tia Brown, Councilmember Donnie Anderson, and City Administrator Jenny Rosenkrantz here from Cody, here for Wham. Please join me welcome them.
We are at that order of business. Bills on second reading.
Mr. Speaker, could I have one more privilege of the floor?
Please proceed.
I had to run upstairs and see if she was sitting up there. The historic American who ran the 5K fun run on July 3rd, 1999, the mother of Thomas Edwin Lubnow III, in the west balcony, my wife Rita.
Standing committee reports.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom is referred Senate File 74 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Camel, Childers, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Frownish, signed Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business and Economic Development, to whom is referred Senate File 15 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Hunt, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, No, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 85 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave, No, Hunt, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
We're at that order of business of bills on second reading. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 51.
House Bill 51, introduced by Representative Madden, an act relating to impact assistant payments, industrial siting impact payments.
House Bill 51, having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a 3rd time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 82.
House Bill 82, introduced by Representative Miller, an act relating to welfare and the personal opportunities with employment responsibilities program, public assistance, drug testing.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to refine my amendment, so at this particular time, I am going to withdraw it and bring it back on a third reading, but the intent is still the same. I believe that if this body wants to exercise its will on the public, it
should... Representative Byrd,
if
you're not going to move the amendment, are you going to withdraw it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Second reading, Amendment number 1 to House Bill 82 having been withdrawn. House Bill 82 having been read 2 separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a 3rd time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We're at that order of business of third reading consent list. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move a consent list consisting of House Bill 66 and House Bill 87.
Does anyone wish to have any one of those bills removed from the consent list? The reading clerk will read the consent list bills through the enacting clause.
House Bill 66, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to industrial siting financial resources, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming. House Bill 87, introduced by Representative Pedersen, an act relating to mixed martial arts, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
Having been read 3 separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the House? Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Blake excused. Blickery.
Aye.
Bonner.
Aye.
Botten.
Aye.
Brechtel.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Burkhart.
Aye.
Byrd.
Aye.
Campbell.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Childers.
Aye.
Connolly.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Davison.
Aye.
Edmonds.
Aye.
Eklund.
Aye.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Freeman.
Aye.
Gay.
Aye.
Gingery.
Aye.
Goggles.
Aye.
Greer.
Aye.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman.
Aye.
Harvey.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Illaway.
Aye.
Yagi. Kasparic. Croker. Crone. Lockhart. Laux. Lubno. Madden. McKim. McComey. Miller. Moniz. Nicholas. Patton. Peasley. Peterson. Peterson. Petroff. Korberg. Reeder. Roscoe. Semlich. Steward. Stubson. Teeters. Throne. Ronish. Wallace. Swanitzer Dan. Swanitzer Dave. Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 59 aye, 1 excused. As to House Bill 66, are there any changes? Throne? Throne conflict. Esquivel? Aye to no. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 57 aye, 1 no, 1 excused, 1 conflict. As to House Bill 87, are there any changes? Eklund, aye to no. Brechtel, aye to no. Laux, aye to no. Hunt, aye to no. Miller, aye to no. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 54 aye, 5 no, 1 excused.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the House, House Bills 66 and 87 have passed the House. We are at that order of business of consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. House is resolved into committee of the whole. Representative Madden.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if we pay attention and stay on point, we should be able to get out of here by noon. The Committee of the Whole, please come to order. First bill for our consideration is House Bill 112. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 112, introduced by Representative Barbuto, an act relating to crimes and offenses, battery against a family member. This bill is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Peasley, Throne, No, Brechtel, Nicholas. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 112 do pass, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the sponsor.
Representative Barbuto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of you might remember this bill. It came through our House last year during the general session, but didn't make it out of the drawer on the other side of the hall. House Bill 112, battery against a family member, originated from a conversation I had with my county attorney. They were frustrated that they could not always get the second conviction for battery against a family member. because of the current state of our statutes. In order to be charged with subsequent convictions of this crime, it had to happen within so many years of the previous conviction. So if you have your bill in front of you, if you look at the second page, currently in order to receive the second conviction, it would have to happen within 5 years of the first. In order to receive the third conviction, which is the felony level, that would have to happen within 10 years of the second. So this bill goes in and takes out that language, takes out those look-back periods, and then also on page three, if you look at it, it takes the felony level fine from $2,000 up to $10,000, which is consistent with other felonies, and the imprisonment from not more than 5 years to not more than 10 years, which is also consistent with our other statutes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think this is going to have a positive impact on victims all across the state and give prosecutors another tool in their toolbox to combat domestic violence, and I stand for questions.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number one. It's not lightly I bring this amendment. In committee, we had the same amendment. It went down a 4-4 tie. We're talking about a misdemeanor crime here, and we're removing the look-back altogether. So if somebody commits a crime at the age of 18, and now they're 80, that misdemeanor is still being held against them. And I just don't think that's fair or just. So I think what we need to do is have some compromise and increase that 5-year penalty to 10 years. So the amendment's very simple, reinserting that language and putting for a 10-year look-back. Now, what kind of crimes are we talking about? Right there, that's one battery. That's two battery. That's three battery. That's what this amendment is for. That's a fourth battery. That's a fifth battery, if I did that to another person. So right now, that's a battery. So right now, I'm just trying to make this for a 10-year look back, not making this indefinite for 18 years. Now you're 80 years old. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising in support of the amendment, I was part of the four trying to amend this in committee. I just think it's reasonable if we put some type of a time frame, particularly if you have individuals that have one or two batteries currently on their record. And if they're simple batteries or assaults, by the way, it doesn't even have to be a battery. It just can be an assault, so a threat to harm somebody. I just think if we put a reasonable time frame on it that we'll address the harm representative is trying to address, and so I would move the amendment.
Any more remarks pertaining to the amendment? Okay, we're on Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chair.
Ooh, I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Go ahead. Rising on and against the amendment, just with a little history, the policy decision of the legislature was to have these look-back periods for whatever reason. And I think it's time that we reexamine the policy, and that's exactly what the bill does. And with the idea being that whether it's 5 years or 10 years, you have to have more than two convictions to even get to the felony level. So even after two, it's still a misdemeanor. And I guess I don't understand how, and we're talking about domestic violence. We're not talking about just a battery tapping on, you know, your buddy, even if it's rude, insolent, and angry. We're talking about domestic violence. And I don't feel like somebody should learn their lesson the first time. You get one conviction. If you get another one within 5 years, 10 years, or ever, you've had your shot at that. And I just think it's a serious problem in the state. I think it's a serious problem in the country. And I don't think we should have any look-back periods on here. When you take, speaking directly to the committee, the whole amendment, so we strike the five like the bill did, and we insert 10. That makes it a little better, but even 10 years. I just don't understand why we would have leniency in this type of battery. If you're 18 and you get in a fight at the bar or something like that, and then later on you get into domestic, this doesn't affect you because the first one wasn't a domestic. But if you've got a second domestic offense, there's a bigger issue there, And I don't think you should have the luxury of saying, well, the last time I beat on somebody that was a household member, it was more than 10 years ago, so that first one doesn't count. It's too serious. So on and against the amendment.
Chairman Brown. Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, and to follow up on the previous speaker, you know, what this amendment would do is tell the judge that he can't take into consideration something that happened beyond the look-back period. And judges do this all the time. If it's really serious, there's going to be a pre-sentence investigation. Judges look at offenders every day and take it all into account. And so something that was 15 or 20 years back may be significant or it may not be. But if we pass this amendment, we're telling the judge, you can't look at that. You can't take that into consideration when you make a decision on this case. And I hate to take that away from the judges. I trust their discretion. They see this kind of stuff day in and day out and have the experienced eye to give a previous situation whatever weight it deserves. And so for that reason, I'm against the amendment. I'd just like to leave the judge with the option, if it's appropriate, to take into consideration something that happened more than 10 years ago. Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, on and against the amendment, domestic violence is a cycle. And whether you have a look back or whether you don't, it is a cycle. And it starts with the honeymoon period, and that's how the people get together. And boy, can there be charm going very strongly. And then after the honeymoon is over with, then you start with a little bit of verbal abuse. And why didn't you do this, and why didn't you do that? And then it gets to where, and I expect you to do this or that, and then I will discipline you to do this or that. And then it gets to pretty severe violence until there is a stopper. And then it's, oh, I really messed up. Oh, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. We're going back to the beginning. And then there's a honeymoon again. And boy, you go, yeah, I can forgive you for all those things. And then the verbal abuse starts again. And so how long is the cycle? How short is the cycle? How long is the verbal abuse? How long are the beatings? It doesn't matter. It's not right. And I think judges need to have the ability to look at cycles. They need to have the ability to look at personalities. They need to have the ability to look at if people have exercised the opportunity to get help. I think that the fines in this bill are disgraceful, particularly when you look at the game and fish violations. You can beat your wife cheaper than you can poach big game. I think that the attitude of our floor and the attitude of this state has got to change, and we have got to develop an attitude of intolerance of this kind of behavior. And until we change our attitudes, people will not change their actions. And the look-back period or no look-back period, I think judges need all the tools that they have in their toolbox so that they can look at people. And I'm not talking about just men beating women or women beating men. It happens both ways. But I think that the judge needs the discretion of all of the facts, so that he can look at patterns, so that he can make judgment. That's why we put him in that chair, is so that he can make judgments. What are we going to do? What is our attitude toward domestic violence? And how are we going to change attitudes outside of this chamber if we don't change attitudes inside this chamber? On and against the amendment and for the bill.
Any remarks on the amendment? Representative Gingrey?
Thank you, you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify one part of this. There was the statement earlier that you just hit someone, that's battery. I just wanted to actually read you the elements of the crime for a battery. It's if you intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause bodily injury to another person by use of physical force. So it's not just hitting a person. You'd actually have to cause bodily injury. So there are elements of the crime, bodily injury being physical pain, illness, or any impairment of physical condition. Also, I point out it's not any person. In this, it's household member is what we're dealing with. So it's battery of a household member.
Representative Barbuto, do you have...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I just want to say I do appreciate the bringer of this amendment's reasonings for bringing the amendment. It's certainly a good discussion to have. I don't know that I would call it it's certainly not a friendly amendment, probably not an unfriendly. This is more like a casual acquaintance amendment, the kind you try to avoid at a party. And for all the reasons outlined, I mean, I want to give you an example. You know, a person who was convicted of possession of marijuana in 1972, if they were convicted again in 2012, that would be their second conviction. I think we can hold that same sort of standard to domestic violence that we do possession of a controlled substance and a multitude of other statutes. So I ask you to resist the amendment and vote for the bill. Thank you.
Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor? Ooh. Sorry. Representative Green.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A person is guilty of unlawful contact if he touches another person in a rude, insolent, or angry manner without intentionally using sufficient physical force to cause bodily injury, and that is the statute we are amending. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Majority Floor Leader, Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last session, or was it the session before that? I can't remember. Had some constitutional problems with our battery statute, and so we changed our battery statute into a unlawful touching and a battery statute. The rude, insolent, or angry manner is the battery. The unlawful touching is, I can't remember what the language the good representative from Laramie just read. The reason that we did that is because if you get a domestic violence battery, under the Lautenberg Amendment of the Federal Constitution, you can't carry firearms rights for the rest of your life. And there was a case called the Hayes case that said that battery has to be intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing bodily injury to another person. So then we did an unlawful conduct, which is the rude, insolent, or angry manner without using sufficient forces to cause bodily injury, or recklessly causing bodily injury. If you're charged under the unlawful contact statute, you don't lose your firearm rights. If you're charged under the battery statute, you lose your firearm rights. And with that, I'll sit down.
Any more discussion on the amendment? Representative Nichols?
I will propose on a follow-up amendment is just to take out G, and I think that might address the problems that we're talking about here. Because what we're trying to prevent is people who are guilty of a rude or insolent touching shouldn't be a felony on a third conviction, and so I think that would probably more address the issue. By the way, in terms of sentencing, even though you can't, you can only go back 5 years or 10 years or no years, in the sentencing, the judge can go back as long as he wants, as far as he wants, in considering a sentence. This just means the amount of sentence he can impose. So a judge can always go back and look at your prior record, regardless of what it is, in terms of how he's going to sentence you. So I just want to clarify that if you've got a prior bad history, the judge is going to know about it, and he'll take that in consideration on his sentencing. Thank you.
Okay, we're on the amendment. All those in favor of the committee of the whole amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment fails. Any remarks on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, you do so with the recommendation that Bill number 112 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The bill is passed the House, or passed first reading of the House.
Committee of the Whole.
Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 35 and Representative Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. First,
got to read it.
We have to read the bill.
House Bill 35 introduced by Representative Greer, an act relating to notarial certification of business entity instrument. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yeagy, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dam, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 35, Notarial Certification of Business Entity Instruments, do pass, and the good representative from House District 27 will explain the bill.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I do have a confession. My undergraduate degree is in economics, and so the majority floor leader asked me to be brief this morning.
Out of order.
All right. This was supposed to be a simple bill that caused a little bit of a stir. I will try to be brief. This is a short form. Under our statutes, we have several short forms. And what they are is a sample of language to use in circumstances that are deemed to be or presumptively are deemed to presumptively comply, I think I'm saying that wrong, with the statute. The whole idea here was with our Notarial Officers Act that we passed last year, good legislation. The requirements for acknowledging a document for a corporation are a bit cumbersome in that the law itself requires that the notarial officer determine the person who signed the instrument on behalf of the business entity. They have to verify who that person is and then have that person swear and affirm that they are the president if it's a corporation and that they have the authority to sign the document. I thought that this would be much easier if we worked up a short form and had it placed in the statute so that people would know the exact form, the exact wording to use. Some of you may have been receiving emails from the county clerk's office. They were concerned that this short form was changing the law, and it is not changing the law. It is exactly what the law we passed last year says. It just provides people with a form to use so that they can do it correctly. And I hope you all have that were receiving emails have got the last email which said, yes, we agree. We were reading it wrong. We don't have any problems with it. And so I'll just keep this very brief. If there are any questions on this, please ask me, and I'll be more than happy to explain them. If there are none, I would encourage you to vote in favor to move this along. Thank you.
Questions on this bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that bill number 35 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 35 is passed the Committee of the Whole. Next item on our agenda is House Joint Resolution 8. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution Number 8, introduced by Representative Lockhart. A joint resolution requesting Congress and the Wyoming Governor to designate the fourth Saturday in July as National Day of the Cowboy. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bechtel, Burkhart, Connolly, Freeman, Croker, Crone, Laux, Teeters, No. Madden. Signed, Representative Teeters, Chairman.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Joint Resolution 8 do pass. And I will turn the bill over to the sponsor from Casper.
Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, from Education. I noted that it passed handily in your committee. If there was ever a state that ought to be pushing for a National Day of the Cowboy, it's Wyoming. The bill just basically is a resolution to encourage our state and the U.S. Congress to do that. This has come about, the request to me to at least sponsor it, from the widow of Senator Thomas. Senator Thomas had this introduced in 2005, 2006, 2007, and it passed at the Senate. Subsequent to his no longer being a senator, for reasons we all know, the United States Congress has passed it every year. And this is just to reinforce that dynamic that we have for recognizing a day a year for the cowboy. Rather than prolong this, I would stand for any questions any of you may have.
Questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Teeter's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 8 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Joint Resolution 8 is passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 89. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 89, introduced by Representative Lubna, an act relating to workplace safety, employer assistance. This bill is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Hunt, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Sepson, Swanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 89 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the working of the Committee of the Whole bill, and turn the explanation of the bill and the working of the Committee of the Whole amendment over to the good majority leader.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last night you received a handout that had some cheese on the front of it. If you want to pull that out, I bring you House Bill 89, Worker Safety Employer Assistance. And like to spend some time discussing a little bit about worker safety. As you all know, Wyoming bears the dubious distinction of being the most unsafe place to work in the nation. Some of our industries are the safest industries in the world. Some of our industries are the most dangerous industries in the world. And people who go to work should come home at night, and we should strive to do that. There are reasons why people get injured at work, and the aviation industry in the late 1970s did a great deal of research on, because their planes were mechanically reliable, but they were still crashing, on why these injuries happened. If you look at the Swiss cheese chart, that's called Reason Swiss Cheese Model. And what happens is that if it takes all of the holes in different pieces of Swiss cheese lining up before a bad thing happens. And so people get away with unsafe acts over and over and over again until one of those cheese wheels rotates just right, and then the event goes all the way through and somebody gets hurt. So the plan to change the culture and create workplace safety is to rotate those wheels and line them up in such a way that bad things don't happen. Well, what the FAA found out was that you had to change the culture. And you can't change the culture with penalties alone. And that is because nobody believes that they're going to kill somebody at work when they get up and go to work that day. Or they don't believe that they're going to injure a coworker. And so the penalties come into play after the cow is already out of the barn, because nobody believes that they violated anything or hurt anybody because the cheese wheels didn't rotate right. Well, if you turn to the next thing, it's a hazardous attitude inventory. And that's the attitudes that cause people to work unsafely. And if you saw the package and didn't read it and just threw it away, that would be the anti-authority hazardous attitude. If it came to your desk and you wanted to get it cleared off, that would be the impulsive hazardous attitude. If you saw the attitude and said, I don't need to worry about this, I don't have a hazardous attitude, that would be the invulnerability hazardous attitude. If you said, I don't need to take no stinking test, I know what my attitudes are, that would be the macho hazardous attitude. And if you said, this is more thick email from that majority floor leader, why should I bother reading it? That would be the resignation hazardous attitude. Well, so how do you go about changing cultures? Well, what the aviation industry found out is that you do it better with carrots than sticks. And so what this bill does is it creates a friendly culture change type of process based in the aviation industry's experience and in science. So what does it do? Well, it's a two-step process. The first is workplace safety grants, where an individual can apply for a grant. The grants are limited to $10,000. The appropriation is $250,000, and it comes out of the industrial accident account. It doesn't come out of the general fund. It comes out of workers' compensation premiums, which is where these funds are constitutionally mandated to be paid. So if the program doesn't work, people complain because premiums go up. If the program works, premiums go down and everybody's happy. So that's where the funds come from. It's got a 10% participation limit. So if somebody wants to get a grant, they have to participate at least to 10%. And it's for safety programs and safety equipment. The other part of the bill, the operative part, is for 5 courtesy inspectors. And you'll notice that the bill title is cleverly crafted by a sneaky majority floor leader to just be employer assistance and not worker safety. That is that way because I think it's very important as the sponsor of this bill that the courtesy inspections not be punitive. That there are companies that are so small that they can't afford the elaborate safety companies, the large industries that I have in my community where they go millions of man hours without a lost time injury. But that knowledge is out there and that ability is out there. Right now, we have 2 courtesy inspectors. There's up to a 6-month wait. The program has not been advertised, but those people who have gone through the program believe it's a very, very successful program. These courtesy inspectors, you'll see $1 million appropriation after. That's because the program is effective immediately. Those positions go down to $750,000 then. Those are funded from the industrial accident account. Now, you will recall that this body authorized the hiring of an epidemiologist a few years ago. The purpose of hiring the epidemiologist was to say, let's develop a bill based on good science that's going to have results. Well, the epidemiologist issued a report critical of this legislature, saying that this legislature was not interested in worker safety, to which I said, no fair, that's preposterous. This bill implements every recommendation contained in that epidemiologist report. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions. The Standing Committee Amendment, the Committee of the Whole Amendment.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are 2 Committee of the Whole amendments, and I'd like to ask for the explanation of the Committee of the Whole number 1. to be handled by our good representative from Rollins, as he has a career in this area. So with that, I'd ask him to explain Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chairman Lockhart. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, I
want to move the amendment.
Okay. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 and ask for your favorable consideration.
Okay, we're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment was an amendment asked for by the Minerals Committee. The bill calls for reports to be generated, and there was some discussion of what needs to be in those reports so that we can determine if this bill has a positive effect or not. And that's the entire amendment, is to define what is in those reports so that the Minerals Committee, when the report comes back to them, can make an adequate decision if this bill is achieving the desired results or not. Requires that they indicate the number of grants issued, the total amount of funds on those grants, the number of employees covered by the programs created and enhanced under this act, percent increase or decrease of employees injured or killed while working for employer who received grants under the program. And I think there's a typo there that should be employers and not employees. And a comparison by industry and job classification of the percentage of employees injured or killed who received grants. Very direct, not a lot of statistical analysis. That would be done by the state epidemiologist. But it gives the Minerals Committee the opportunity to gauge whether this program is effective or not. This bill achieves the desired results. And with that, I would stand for questions on the amendment.
Discussion on the amendment. Representative Lubnow.
No discussion on this amendment, Mr. Chairman, just the next one.
Representative Lockhart.
I would only urge your support of the amendment number 1, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Okay, all those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 and ask for your favorable consideration. After the bill went through committee, the Department of Workforce Services said you gave us one extra position. Would you please take a position away for courtesy inspectors? So the amendment deletes 3 and reduces that to 2, and deletes 8 and reduces the number of courtesy inspectors to 7. They think they can handle it with 7 courtesy inspectors.
We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2. Any discussion? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion, the amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill. Any remarks on the bill? Oh, Representative Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. On page 2, line 2, I'm just wondering, it says upon application from a public or a private employer, so does this mean that state agencies and can apply for this grant money? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lubnow?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. And Mr. Chairman, that also means not only public employers who are state agencies, but hospitals, counties, cities, towns, any political subdivision who has employees at risk can apply for this assistance or ask for this courtesy assistance or these grants.
Representative Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like a follow-up on that, because I guess one of my concerns is that this grant process will be so competitive that perhaps the industries that really need the assistance are not going to be able to get the assistance that they need. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that it's not a lot of money, and I agree that we have to trust our Department of Workforce Services to rank the grants
You'll see in the bill on page 2 the criteria. We give them rulemaking authority to administer the rules and regulations for the program and rank the grants and the grant applications. To my way of thinking, if it's competitive to get these funds and people are asking the state of Wyoming for help, then perhaps that's a good thing in making our workplaces more safe.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you for your latitude, Mr. Chairman. You know, I guess I'm just going to push back on this public idea because it just seems to me that the state surely and other public employers should have the funds to keep their own workplaces safe. I just don't see any reason to include the public in this piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Lockhart, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the other chairman's question on that, the larger corporations do have a lot of these things. We were really targeting where many of the accidents are, the smaller ones, and trying to help them reach out and get some help that works easily for them. So it's an effort, really, to get those that don't have the money in their budgets for this kind of thing, and we can improve the safety of our workforce in Wyoming.
Okay, any other discussion on the bill? Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pushback on the pushback. There are places, there are governmental entities that cannot afford these kind of programs. I guess they can look to our dollars and through appropriation come by other means, but if they're paying into the workers' compensation fund and covering their workers, if you're a small water and sewer district, if you're a very small town with limited employees, those employees should be entitled to the same type of safety protections as the small employers. Now, I agree that I would focus primarily on private employers, but I think that the Department of Workforce Services needs to rank these things on the greatest number of employees served by these grants and let them make those decisions based upon the epidemiologist factors. What are the riskiest industries? What are the riskiest jobs? What has been the track record, and where can we make the biggest difference? And I just hesitate doing this from this body, but would like to give those options available. If the body would like to remove the public language, and there's an amendment to do that, whatever the body's pleasure is, you've heard my arguments there.
Representative Broscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I applaud the bringer of the bill. We do have the worst record in the nation for worker safety, and I think we're averaging a death every 10 days. And I can relate directly to the cheese analogy myself. However, I am disappointed that we're not addressing fines. I think you might wake up and think that you're not going to hurt another worker during your day, but if you are in charge, if you're the CEO of a small company in the gas field, you might wake up and say that it would benefit me more to put in this $500 safety railing than have a stiff fine to pay at the end. So I think we, as a body, should consider this in the future. Thank you.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I ended my career with the third largest mining company in the world as a team lead for health, safety, and environment. And that industry has a admirable record of many, many Sentinels of Safety Awards in the Powder River Basin, which are based on the most man hours worked without incident, and many of those mines have gone years and years, millions and millions of man hours, and the way that it is done is precisely with this kind of program. It is a culture change, and I have worked in the oil and gas industry, and I can tell you that that's a very different culture. That's a culture that has a kind of a machismo, maybe would be the right word. You know, there's risk taking that is maybe unnecessary. that happens. And what these companies are struggling with is just using the hammer, putting up the fines is never going to change the way individual workers behave. That's an intrinsic thing that companies can encourage, that this program would help make available to companies that don't have the resources of the third largest mining company in the world. And I just can't, I like the way this is funded. I think it's appropriate. I think it will do an enormous amount of good. And one of these days we will be able to brag about not only the safety record in our largest industries, but the safety record in our smallest industries. And I think that's good for the state, and I encourage you to support this.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would echo those same sentiments, and I applaud the good majority floor leader for bringing this forward to the body. Being a worker in one of those industries with large equipment, two large companies that work in this state that haul a good majority of our coal out of this state, and when you're looking at equipment that big, and things that go that fast and have that much horsepower, you don't hear about a lot of injuries or deaths within that railroad industry. And the reason is because they have these types of programs. We have a program called Total Safety Culture, and it does bring awareness to the job that is at hand and the safety issues. And I think if we can bring that culture to some of these smaller businesses that don't have those opportunities, we're going to start to see a change in one of those areas where we're leading the nation, and it's not a real proud position to be in. So we do need to address a serious issue in this state, and I think this is a good step.
Representative Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on and for this bill, but since the word machismo came up for the industry that I worked for 32 years, and I'm familiar with a lot of majors and independent companies, I would like the body to understand without a doubt there are a lot of those companies that have excellent safety records and safety programs. I personally went through three different programs for the company that I work for, finishing with the STOP program, if anybody's familiar with that. And it's a highly intensive safety program. So machismo, that word, can apply to just about any business within the United States or in the state of Wyoming. And it's a problem that companies have to work with to get rid of, because of machismo attitude in the workplace. It shouldn't be there. I'll admit that. But for my industry, very good programs.
Representative Peasley.
Mr. Chairman, I've taken my meds, so don't get worried. There was something about the comment about machismo that just drew me to the microphone. And I always say, quien es más macho? And I say, Paco. See? That's, that's what they say in Spain. My only comment on this is that the irony of our feel good bill here following up our declaration of the Cowboy Day. Everything in this seems contrary to cowboy. And in fact, when I'm reading it, I'm seeing John Wayne's name behind every, I'm sorry about that. I marked me down, Mr. Pedersen. I go again. But I guess my concern is that this is probably a great thing, and safety's great. And I know, but this constant talking about the culture, of lack of safety bothers me, because so many of the people in this body are pointing their crooked finger at Wyoming and saying, we're unsafe, we're the most unsafe place in the world. Well, we do unsafe things here. We have the kind of people that aren't afraid to crawl up on a rig or build a windmill or to ride a horse or a bull. So I just, let's go a little easier on the cowboy state when we start saying that we have machismo people here. Things get done through those people. Let's try to, when we celebrate us being the cowboy state and the day of the cowboy, let's remember that those are the guys that weren't afraid to do the tough things. If we want to be purely safe, go live in that pablum vanilla wafer societies that we have in a lot of our other states where they don't do anything dangerous. Let's push for the safety. I'm not necessarily against the bill, but I want us to stop picking on Wyoming. Thank you.
Any more discussion? Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to tell you very briefly is a small company here in Wyoming. That company used this process that the bill provides for others for. And they didn't kill anybody. Nobody died. But they did manage in a very short period of time to destroy a very valuable piece of equipment, to destroy a semi-tractor trailer, injure a number of people over time. They took this to heart, this concept of improving the culture. They worked with the state agencies on these consultation programs. They turned themselves around to where actually their safety program became a competitive advantage against other companies. They could underbid other companies because they weren't paying the money out in workers' comp because they weren't hurting people. And that's what this is about, to extend that sort of culture to others, to other companies. Workforce Services is going to prioritize these. The very large companies that we have in the state, again, as other speakers have said, they don't need these programs. They have their own. The small companies need as much help as they can get because, on the average, the worker we kill every 10 days is working for a medium to small-sized company. Those are the companies that need help. This bill provides them both the knowledge and some money to help them buy equipment. Safety equipment is not cheap. So, on and for the bill, please.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other comment that I didn't hear this morning, and that is the commitment of the Department of Workforce Services for this redirection and to get us the kinds of safe working practices offered to those that are willing. And I think we'll have a good program. And when we get this report in 2013, I'm hopeful it'll be everything in the right direction. I urge your support of the bill.
Any more discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that Bill number 89 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay. House Bill 89 is passed, Committee of the Whole. Next item on the agenda is next bill for our consideration is House Bill 34. Representative Illaway.
I have to read it.
Oh, I'm sorry. The reading clerk will read the bill. What?
House Bill 34, introduced by Representative Throne, an act relating to subdivisions, consideration of schools. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Patton, Roscoe, Zwanitzer, Dan, No, Croker, Stubson, Sign Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment, which is Substitute 1.
Okay. You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to have the bringer of the bill, the good representative from House District 11, discuss the bill.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chairman Illaway. I didn't mean to do that. This bill is an effort to provide counties with an additional tool in the subdivision process to help communities plan for schools. It's in a substitute form because, as you may recall on introduction, we had some discussion about the framework of the bill, and thanks to the good help of the Speaker Pro Tem, we decided to put the operative language in a different provision, in a different section of our subdivision statutes. So that's the reason for the substitute bill. The bill allows counties to require schools to plan with subdivision developers for future school development if it's necessary. This is at the option of the counties. The counties do not have to implement this in their subdivision provisions. And you can see that on page 2 of the substitute bill under subsection A. There are a number of things in subsection A, if you have your green books, that counties are required to do in the subdivision process. Already under existing law, they're not required to do what's found in Romanet 12. So what we're doing with the new language for school review is adding Romanet 13, which you'll see on page 2, which just creates a review process between the subdivision board or the subdivision developer and the school board to talk about schools up front. And again, counties are not required to include this piece in their subdivision regulations. Now, my county is a county that can use this. That may not be true for all counties. And so that's why it's optional. It's not intended to be a mandatory part of the subdivision process. And what we found in Laramie County is that when the school board and the developer start talking early in the process, they set aside land for schools, and everything works just fine. And that's happened. We heard testimony from our school board members in the Corporations Committee that it's worked well in Laramie County on most occasions to have this informal process. But on one occasion, it did not work so well. The developer and the school board did not have good communication involving school location, and it led to a lot of bad feelings, to put it mildly, on all sides. And consequently, right now, that subdivision, which could use a school, is not the next school to be built in Laramie County. It was basically a big mess. And through the course of those discussions, I happened to be on one of our local radio talk shows, and somebody called in and said, well, I've lived other places where the developer's required to consider this before they can even get their permit. Why don't you do that in Wyoming? I'm like, I don't know. So I started doing a little research or asking our staff to do a little research, and found out that it's not unusual in other states to require this. And certainly I think the important thing for the body to know is that cities in our state can already do this, but counties do not have the authority. So the purpose, again, of this bill is to just give counties this tool if they want to use it to plan for schools up front with developers. And then it goes through the subdivision permitting process, and this hopefully prevents the kind of problems we've had here. It may not be a tool your counties need now, but somewhere down the road it might be a useful tool for them. And I would certainly stand for any questions.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would urge caution on the bill before you. I would commend the sponsor for her hard work on the bill. You can see from the substitute bill that it was worked over pretty heavily in committee, and certainly is a better bill now than it was when it went in. But there are still significant concerns and problems with the bill that really I mean, the bill is sort of a product of one instance in the capital city, and we're leaping to a whole new system of how we look at schools and school placement and school siting around the state. And one of the real concerns, if you look through those requirements that we have for subdivisions, you can see item by item, they are things, actual impacts of that subdivision, whether it be, you know, on conservation issues, on water issues, and what have you. It's actual impacts of that subdivision. But what you have here, I mean, we all know that schools and school boundaries can reach well beyond a subdivision. So you can create a situation under this bill where maybe you have a smaller subdivision and then another one and then another one and then finally one that sort of springs the concern for building a school in a rural area. And so you could have the final subdivider all of a sudden saddled with the responsibility of answering the development responsibilities of all the surrounding subdivisions. And there's no protection against that in this bill. I mean, the board would be within their authority under this bill to say, well, you're the last one, but tough. You're the one that has to reserve the land to provide an educational opportunity for all these other folks out here in this area. And so that's a real concern and a real step beyond what we have done previously, which is allowing a requirement for them to account for the impacts of others in the area, not just the subdivision. The other there's some other real concerns that were raised in committee by folks when you look at the ability to mandate a reservation of a piece of property for construction of a school. How long do you have to hold that property as a developer? If you set aside a chunk of land, how long do you have to let it sit there until they either decide to build a school, not to build a school? And, you know, if it's 20 years down the road, then where is that developer in trying to either market that property or redevelop that property? And there's no timelines or anything like that on this power of reserving lands for school districts. So this is a fairly significant step beyond what we have done before, and I would just ask you to look real hard on it before you vote aye.
Representative Eklund?
My question was kind of down the... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question's down the same line. So the developer continues to own the land. I may be missing something in the bill. I'm curious, is the school district going to buy the land, or will the homeowners association hold it, the developer hold it, the state hold it? I guess I'm missing that part and wondering where the cost might be passed on to through the development of the subdivision what do they do with the land until a school's put there?
Representative Greer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in opposition to this bill as well, and I don't want to repeat what the earlier speaker had said, but, you know, the concern is this being applied, could be applied unfairly. And the fact is that I just feel uncomfortable leaving this tool out there that could be abused later on. And if these are real concerns, your municipalities have the authority through their zoning process, and some counties have actually taken the step to zone. So I just, again, urge caution in moving this forward.
Representative Throne. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Peterson, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some reservations about this. When it comes time to reservation of this particular property, I fail to see where there's any criteria in there and how long this reservation is going to go, because you can have a downturn in the economy and that land can sit for a long period of time. Then the just compensation is paid to the developer that may have it. Because when he goes into this, he has certain costs that are incurred in doing one of these subdivisions, and then over a period of time, the land values can certainly erode, and as a result, he's left out here. So I think there's a lack of criteria here. Time element is not certain here, and the amount of land that would be reserved for a school is also lacking, so I'd certainly urge caution on this legislation.
Representative Blickery.
Mr. Chairman, fellow representatives, I've been a school board member
on the committee looking for land to build a school. Many times land that is reserved by a realtor that is making a subdivision is not suitable for a school. It's not big enough to put a school on, and it causes problems down the road. The good part of this bill is that it would just put into the process that a developer should talk with a school district about the possibility of a school to give them an opportunity to make their plans. I agree that if a school district wants that area because they believe they're going to need a school in there, that they should pay the proper amount of money and they should do it quickly so that the owner doesn't have this vacant land sitting there forever that he can't do anything with. I agree, that's a problem with this bill. But the real important part of this bill is the communications. Because when you are a school district trying to plan for your future, if you're not included in the process to know where subdivisions are going to be, how can you do it? And I'm going to say one other thing. From my experience, both in the banking industry and in being in school boards, the first thing that any realtor does when they're trying to sell the lots in their subdivision is advertise that there's going to be a school there. And they do that because people want to live where there's going to be a school. So I know that there's some problems here. But the most important part about it is getting it into the process so that all the people are talking to each other so your school district can plan. My school district has grown by 2,500 students in about 7 years. And I can tell you that is serious growth that requires serious planning. And you also, when you're planning, you have to work with the State Schools Facilities Commission, with this body, all those places. And then that takes a lot of time. And that's why I urge you, please vote for this and then bring your amendments to fix the parts you don't like. But the most important part of this is the communications. Thank you.
Representative Throne. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I had a similar experience, only I was the mayor. And we had a big developer coming to town, and we told them that we wanted them to set aside, I mean, it was a huge subdivision area. It's called the Dillon subdivision. And so we got with the school board, and we got with the developer, and they set aside this nice big area, and it's now a park, because that's everybody decided that we wanted a school on that side of town. We didn't have one. Well, 20 years later, when we're starting to build new schools, new boards of trustees, new plans on and new way to do it, middle schools and still elementary schools, is a lot of changes, and to my knowledge, that's probably going to remain a park that the city has to take care of forever. So those are some of the things. The communication part of it, I agree totally with the previous speaker. But it's pretty hard to tie some of this stuff down sometimes if the impact is not going to be so great that you're going to be building a new school or know where that's going to be.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is that in counties that currently do have zoning and planning, and some don't, but most do now, do they have the ability through rule and regulation to deal with subdivisions and this issue?
Representative Throne, got some questions.
Well, I appreciate all the comments. Again, working our way back, the land is reserved by the school district, or reserved for acquisition by the school district. And certainly, if there's discomfort with the lack of a time frame in that, we could put the time frame in the bill, or, typically in the permitting process, that could be agreed to between the developer, the school board, and then the county commission. So that's not a fatal flaw to the bill. That's that's a tweak that we can make. With regards to zoning, it may be not to the same extent. It's not clear that counties have this authority. That's why we put it in the bill. But certainly it needs to be something that county commissioners have a framework for considering. If it's a tool that's available in zoning, it's not being used in a widespread way. I know the good speaker pro tem brought this up on an introduction in his county, which has more extensive regulations than any county in the state uses it. But again, it's a tool we need in the county commissioner provisions. It's a tool that's optional for each county. They don't have to do it. And it's establishing that all-important framework for communication that I think is essential and that can avoid problems down the road. And as our cities grow and we have development on the edge of town, which is what happened here, then there's no mechanism for the planning. And it can work hand in glove with the school facilities process, as our school board either testified in committee or has provided that information to us, that they can work through the school facilities process to get the money to acquire the land. In our case, our school district has to plan so far in advance. They actually have a bank of sites that they purchase so that they can plan ahead. I believe I've answered all the questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Illoway's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that Bill number 34 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Chairs in doubt. Everybody, those who voted aye, stand up. Did that pass? Okay. House Bill 34 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Hillary.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, in the back gallery over my head is a former page that was here several years ago. And she turned into, she's a lovely lady. She's been with Cheyenne Frontier Days. She is now Miss Rodeo Wyoming. And she's competing for Miss Rodeo America in December. Please say hello to Kim Kuhn.
Representative Roscoe.
Privilege of the floor.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce a friend of mine from Pinedale, who is on the Junior Town Council and now going to junior college and working his way towards UW, Casey Terrell up in the balcony up there.
Welcome to the House. Okay. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 18. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 18, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to water notification of public land tenants' water rights changes. This bill was referred to Committee No. 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Gamel, Davison, Eklund, Hunt, Laux, Moniz, Semlek. No, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Semlek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill No. 18 do pass, and I will give you a brief explanation of the bill. The purpose of this bill came about as a result of some discussion that arose in the interim committee with regard to somewhat less than harmonious relationship between public land tenants and public land managers. And the concern first kind of come about is that, is there a way, is there a possibility that we can have an adjudicated water right on public land that's held by the tenant and also by the federal land manager? And in Attorney General's opinion and some other research would indicate that while anybody can permit a water well on anybody's land, including public land, to hold that adjudicated water right, you really need to show beneficial use, and that water right sticks with the owner of the land, which in this case would be the public land manager. So while we don't set out to change anything in regards to that relationship on who can hold the adjudicated water right in Wyoming, we do have some propositions in House Bill 18 that would allow notice and consent on the part of a tenant who's has a grazing permit, let's say, for example, on state or public land, and that's found on page 2, line 2 and 3. So there already is requirements. This is subsection C. If you go back in the statutes and look in subsection A, it does describe the conditions necessary when the owner of a water right wishes to change a water right from its present use or from its present place to another place or for another use. So we're not advocating any change there. We're just saying if a public land manager wants to change the use or place of use of a water right on state or public land, the petitioner shall seek consent for the proposed change from the affected tenant of the land. And it goes down and lists in some of that new language how that notice takes place. And in Romanet I on line 17, it says that the Board of Control in the State Engineer's Office, when they receive an application for a change of use, they should consider the following things. And Romanet I is the economic loss to the tenant caused by the change. Romanet II, whether other sources of water are available for use by the tenant. And on over on the page 3, it talks about whether other sources of water are available to the petitioner for the new use or a place of use. And then subsection D says that in the event consent is not obtained, the tenant may request a hearing in accordance with subsections A of this section. So not a big change here with respect to the relationship between a public land tenant and a public land manager. We just believe that if there is a change contemplated on the part of the public land manager, state or a federal land, that it would be appropriate and proper for them to notify they're contemplating that change. I'll move the standing committee amendment at this time. Standing committee amendment number 1, and this adds some additional stipulations about what's involved if the petitioner is requesting a change in the use or change of place of use with respect to the tenant.
talks about how that's going to be done and the notification of all tenants of their rights to request a hearing. So it just adds a little more language that gives direction as to who all will be notified. If there are no questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, I would call for the question on that.
Question having been called, all those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment, the Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, even though it was a relatively brief explanation, in interest of time, if there's some questions, I'll try to answer that. If not, I would, I'll just try to answer some questions.
Question on the bill. Oh, Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question on page 2 and 3 where you list those matters that should be considered. Are those, I couldn't tell totally clearly from the language now, are those the only things that can be considered, or are those just an example of things that can be considered when determining whether to allow the change?
Representative Semlich.
No, a good question. I guess I'm not that familiar with what all the language is in subsection A that describes the conditions necessary when an owner of a water right wishes to change a water right from its present use. So I'm not sure exactly what's in that section. So there might be things in addition to what's listed under the economic loss, availability of other water. I would assume that this list in a public hearing in front of the Board of Controls, that it would not be an exhaustive list, that the petitioner would have to maybe bring up all other different items besides that. I think that's just probably the normal process in a hearing of a change of use in front of the Board of Control.
Chairman Hillway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions. I used to do a little work when I worked for the Department of Agriculture and with the state engineer, and I just wondered how he views this change, since he's mentioned prominently throughout the bill. I assume that you had him testify. I'd like to know where they are in this whole process.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you for that question, Chairman of the Corporations Committee. The State Engineer's Office has been involved in this, and that prompts me to add a point that I hadn't thought of at this point, that the State Engineer has a memorandum of understanding with the Bureau of Land Management, with the National Forest, and with the state land that addresses many of the same issues in here. So it might beg the question, why do we need this bill? That question was asked during the committee presentation of this bill, and the point was made that these MOUs can be dropped at any time. This would take the MOUs and codify them in statute so that at will neither party can just drop them. So the state engineer has been involved in this discussion.
Representative Blickery.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Semlich, is the purpose of this bill so that the tenants who are occupying or using these public lands will know about these changes with water and then be able to plan?
Chairman Semlich?
To the answer of the good representative from Kalamazoo County, the title of the bill really specifies that is the purpose. It's notification of the public land tenants. If the public land managers wish to petition for a change of use or a change of place of use, that this bill would require, I would assume, I don't think that's happened very often. My good deskmate colleague could probably elaborate on that if it was important. I don't think it happens very often, but in the event that it did happen, again, I would suggest that the relationship between the multiple users of public lands and the public land managers has been less than harmonious over the years. And this would just say that in fairness to a petitioner who wishes to change a water right, if you're on state or federal land, you need to give notice to the tenant so they could have an opportunity in front of the Board of Controls to seek, inquire as to how this might affect their operation. And the Board of Controls, then, they're the final arbiters of that decision, and they can, if the public land tenant doesn't know that these things are happening, well, then they don't have much of a chance to weigh in on the case. So notification of the tenant is what a portion of this bill is about.
Representative Nicholas.
I'm rising in opposition to this bill. In my reading of this bill, it looks like we're trying to tell the state of Wyoming and the federal government that you can't change the use of your water unless the tenant agrees to it and that you set forth the criteria. So if it's going to hurt the tenant but be beneficial to the state or the federal government, we don't care. The tenant is going to have control over the water rights. If you have a contested case hearing and the grounds to modify the change of use are how it's going to best affect the current lessee on the property, then the lessee is controlling the use of the water and not the owner of the property. And so there's a lot more than just notification here. You're establishing the ground rules on whether an owner of property, be it the state or the federal government, can actually change its use. Would you agree with that concept?
Representative Semlich, you want to answer that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I would disagree with that. I think Wyoming law is pretty clear, and the Attorney General's opinion that we sought in relationship to this issue was also fairly clear, that said that the owner of the land holds the water right, that the tenant does not hold the water right. Anybody can permit a water right on anybody's property, but the adjudicated water right has to be with the owner of the land. And this does not change that relationship. I think that's fundamental and important Wyoming water law. This does not change that. And it doesn't allow the tenant to have control over that water right. That water right is with the is held by the owner of the land, in this case the state or the public land manager, and this doesn't change it. It just says, why don't we allow the opportunity for the petitioner of a change of use or a change of place of use to seek consent? The Board of Control, it doesn't say that if consent isn't given for that, it doesn't say that anybody's going to lose their water right. It just says they need to be involved. Let's involve in that process before the Board of Controls in that hearing to allow them to make their case why this change of use shouldn't occur.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also, I'll say a couple of things about this bill, Mr. Chairman. At the heart of this, well, I guess the example that we're trying to address here is a lot of stock water improvements on federal lands, whether it be stock tanks, spring improvements, reservoirs, small ponds. What we've seen in the last several years, the name on the water right has been the federal government. At the heart of this discussion is, does the federal government have the same property rights that you and I have with regard to state-issued water rights granted by the state? And we're trying to address some of this, but we really do need to have a discussion in the future whether or not the federal government is recognized with this bundle that all of us enjoy as property owners in the state of Wyoming. Now, my question about this, there's another issue hanging out there that I've known about for many years, and what we see in many instances on ranches around the state where after someone filed for water rights, the Desert Land Entry Act, occasionally water rights were granted, and those acres were not followed through with a deed to that property owner. So we have some conflicts where we have a state-issued water right in the name of the initial holder of that water right that are overlaid over top of federal lands. My question, Mr. Chairman, what kind of an impact this bill has, what kind of a burden does this place on the water right holder that they may have to notify and gain consent from these federal land managers for them to exercise their water right?
Chairman Semlich, can you answer that? Oh. Representative Nicholas?
I guess my first response is, in terms of this bill, I like the way the chairman thinks on how he wants to control how the federal government may abuse or damage stock water rights and those types of things for lessees. But I would respectfully accept that that's not what this bill does. This bill says that if you don't like the change of use and you're the lessee on say, a state lease, and the state wants to change the water right by diverting it, by moving a stock water pond, whatever it wants to do, and the lessee doesn't like it, they can apply for a hearing in front of the state engineer, and then the state engineer can look at whether or not the economic loss to the tenant, whether or not there is economic loss to the tenant, whether the source of water available for some other location exists, and can look at if there's a new source of water, and under just those criteria, they can say, we're not going to allow the state the change of use, even though you're just the lessee and not the owner of the water right. That's what this bill says when I read it. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but that, if that's the criteria in a contested case hearing, then we're taking away the water right from the from either the state or the federal government and then putting it in the control of the lessee.
Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a variety of tenants on these lands, and we have state lands, we have federal lands. Some of these tenants are long-term tenants and are renewing grazing permits for, I think they can go up to 10 years. I think that's the standard. A lot of state leases can also be renewed up to 10 years. Now, if a lease has got 3 months until expiration, then that's one set of circumstances. If it's got 9 years left until expiration, that's another set of circumstances. And I think what this bill attempts to do is say the tenant has a right to be heard and the state engineer has a right to take into account the circumstances of that particular tenant and adjust the change in use or place of use accordingly to accommodate that tenant. Well, that doesn't bother me a whole lot. I mean, the water is adjudicated to the land. It's a property right that goes with the property ownership of the land. But remember, if you have a tenant on there, and again, it's a mixed bag. In a private lease, in a traditional situation, if you have a tenant on there, the one that has the right of possession of the property is the tenant. Now, when you get to the federal grazing permit, that's a real iffy thing. And then we have the state thing where it's a different than the state, sort of the in-between where the public's got a right to be on there for certain circumstances, but they can't camp overnight. They have to stay on the roads. They can hunt for rocks and stuff like that. On the federal domain, the public has even more rights than that, and the tenants' rights are diminished accordingly. So there's a whole great array of circumstances, and what this does is give the state engineer the latitude. I mean, it's true what the last speaker said, that state engineer could use it as a denial. They could take it into consideration in when the change is going to take place, or they could say that the tenant's tenure is so short, or his use is so tenuous, or his other water rights are, or other water availability is such that it doesn't matter, and he could grant it immediately. But I'm in favor of this bill because I think the state engineer ought to be able to take the circumstances of the tenant in all these myriad situations into account when he makes a decision about whether he's going to grant a change in use and place of use or not. So on and for the bill. Chairman Simmons.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess if I thought that standards that we set forth in this bill with respect to how the state engineer considers a change of use or change of place of use on federal or state land compared to all the considerations they have on change of place of use or change of use on any other place in Wyoming on adjudicated water right, I would be concerned about that. I don't think the standard is that much different, and I guess unless there's any other questions, I would ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no questions, question being called, all those in favor of Representative Semlich's motion and with Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 18 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
House Bill 18 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next item, or the next bill for our consideration is House Bill numbers. Oh, excuse me. Representative Hunt.
Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
Thank you very much. Up here on to your right is some of the Mr. Munger's civic class from Newcastle Middle School. As I understand it, they're broken up into thirds. Some of them were already here. Some of them will be in a little bit later. But they're led by Ryan Akers, who's a sub at Newcastle Middle School. A good friend of mine, went to school with him. But they're down here for the day, so let's make them feel welcome.
Welcome to the House. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 7. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 7, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to voluntary livestock identification program. This bill was referred to Committee number 5, Agricultural State, Public Lands and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Camel, Davison, Eklund, Laux, Moniz, Semlich, Zwanitzer, Dan, No, Hunt, signed Representative Semlich, Chairman. The bill was further referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Escobel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, Wallace, signed Representative Berger, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 7 do pass. It does have a couple amendments. I'll discuss them in a little bit. The livestock industry in Wyoming has taken a pretty clear stand over the years that they do not want to be involved with any federal livestock identification program on a national level. This is not that at all. In fact, we even have a prohibition in statute that says that the state will not be involved in any national program. This is an effort to create a voluntary Wyoming livestock identification. I would much prefer that we just think about it as a traceability program, and what we have done here is provide the livestock board some authority to set up through rule what would be contemplated in a voluntary livestock traceback program. The purpose really for traceback programs can be identified over the last few years when we've had a disease outbreak someplace in the country. Canada had a major one several years ago. And for the protection of the marketability of the livestock in our state, we need to be able to have a mechanism in place that will allow for a traceback when an animal leaves our state, creates some kind of a health problem someplace, to be able to find out if that problem, if it comes back to the state of Wyoming, for instance, is that the source of the problem or did it happen someplace in between? The regulations that we're seeing from the adjoining states are ramping up some of the requirements to be able to send mature cows, for instance, to other states. They are encouraging us, encouraging our neighboring states to have some type of a ability to do a trace back. Certainly within the current brand inspection program in Wyoming with a hot iron brand, we do have a system that's already in place to allow for tracebacks of livestock as long as they move to states that have a brand inspection within their states. You go east river, east of Missouri River, you don't find too many of those states that have that program. So what we've provided here in this bill is authority for the Livestock Board to establish a livestock identification and traceback program, and it's emphasis that it will be on a voluntary basis. It's not the intent of the Livestock Board to develop a lot of new ways to trace back cattle. We'll just use the system some of the systems that we currently have now with individual animal IDs that many producers are already using. It would just provide a kind of a central data bank for this information that we currently collect, and it will allow for a kind of a rapid recovery of this information to trace these animals through a computer program for a brand inspection system. They're already beginning that process, and this will allow them, to continue down that road. Now, the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, it deals with just some, the first place you see that is on page 2, line 15. It talks about the confidentiality of information. It says it will not be released to anybody unless we are, compelled by law to do that. Another portion of that Standing Committee Amendment is, since it is a voluntary program, you get over on page 4, it changed the word required to authorized. I think that's just consistent with a program that's voluntary versus one that's mandatory. And the other thing that we've done is in the appropriations. We had an appropriation in the Standing Committee. We talked about, whether we really need the size of appropriation that was listed in Section 3, the $315,000. I think it was the interest of the committee to go kind of slow on this, that we would provide a much smaller appropriation to allow for the Livestock Board to begin the process of developing the system through rulemaking, and we'll take a look at it at that point and see what's contemplated in the rulemaking and make a decision whether or not we would need additional appropriations down the road. My feeling is that we probably won't, that most of this startup of what's in the Standing Committee Amendment appropriation of $75,000 could certainly be used. If you look at the fiscal note, you could see that even the large amount that's in the Standing Committee amendment is not really totally reflected in the fiscal note, and Committee Number 2 have addressed that when we brought them before that. So, voluntary livestock traceability program, allow the Livestock Board to continue to use many of the same programs and types of IDs that the breed associations are using, that the Livestock Board is using through their brand program to kind of put this information together. Then, through the rulemaking, we can tell our neighboring states that we do have a traceback program in place, and hopefully it won't inhibit the ability for livestock producers to market their animals. There could be some question about, if it's all about marketability, why isn't that the producer's responsibility? Why does the state need to get involved in that? I don't totally disagree with that, but in the case of the disease aspect of it, I think through the rules and regulations in our state veterinarian that we do have an interest in protecting the health integrity of our Wyoming industry. So we're going to ramp the program up slightly. It's not going to be a lot of changes. So I would move the standing committee amendment number one. I think I've pretty well explained most everything that's in that, and ask if there's any questions on the standing committee amendment. If not, call for the question.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We're now up to Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I move standing committee amendment number two to House Bill 7 and ask for your favorable consideration.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Standing committee amendment number two has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on and against the bill, ladies and gentlemen, the number one way to implement a mandatory program is to bring it as a voluntary program the first year and a mandatory program the second year. I think we need to be very cautious about this. The Wyoming Business Council currently has an age and source verification program that will meet the needs of producers if they have concerns about marketability. We're duplicating that, in my opinion. We do have verifiable traceback, as the good chairman did get back around to saying, which I was glad to hear. Our brand program does enable us to do that. It is somewhat cumbersome, but it does work, and no more than we need to do it. It has served us well. I don't think there's any need to go that route. If there is strong need to go that route, I'm curious as to why we're bringing a voluntary program. There are many other people out there that offer agent source programs that you can voluntarily participate in. We're currently looking at one in our business. I don't think the state needs to be involved in it. I think we're duplicating services. They're telling us it's not going to cost anything. You cannot implement any program in state government and tell me that it's going to not increase the workload of someone and cost the taxpayer something. So I would urge you to vote no.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to say some things along the lines of the good chairman from District 5. In addition to the issue of, yes, this is somewhat government meddling in free market, I don't think that the technology itself is there yet. Right now, you've got these little radio chips in the tags, and you run the cattle down the alley, and individually you wave this wand over them, and if for whatever reason you get a false read, the radio transmitter is not working, whatever, then that cow has to be run out of the herd and separated, and then you have to start all over again. And so until a time comes when we can do this in mass, where you can read a truckload of 40, 50 cattle at a time while it's rolling down the road, I just don't think that this is ready, and I do also have concerns about, as the good chairman said, we have this voluntary now, but this is one step toward being mandatory. So please, I would urge you to vote no as well. Thank you.
Chairman Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a question. It was along that line, and it's language on page 3, and it starts on line 19. And it says, shall be voluntary except as otherwise provided by law. So I guess that was kind of a red flag to me, because I was wondering if there's statute already that's going to automatically make this not voluntary, or if this is the out clause to go from voluntary to start the incremental approach to mandatory. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lonzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to think of a word stronger than urge. I beseech you to pass this bill, because, well, we may have messed up on the language of the bill, because whether you love it or you hate it, if you kill this bill, the mandatory national program is still into effect, because what we did in committee is we took the current statute, which talked about taking Wyoming into the national livestock ID program, and we just changed it to a Wyoming ID program. So if you're really against any type of ID program, it's actually worse to vote no now, because the language will stay in that we're part of the national program. So there might be room for a second or third reading amendment, which takes out all of the programs and all the livestock identification if that's the way you want to go. But I would really encourage you not to vote down the bill right now, or you're still stuck with the federal program.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do take issue with that last comment. The national program is not moving forward. The national program has, in my understanding, been dropped because of the fact that we don't have buy-in, the technology is not there, and states feel that it's their responsibility to maintain their statutes over their livestock, not the federal government's. So I take issue with that last comment.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to address those questions. The good chairman of transportation brings up a good question. I flagged that when I was doing my markup on the bill. And that provision in there provides for herd plans in the brucellosis surveillance area. Within that area, we do have some restrictions on the way cattle can be moved. So that, to my knowledge, that is the only provision in law now that's not voluntary. If you're in a brucellosis surveillance area, there's things that you can and cannot do, and that's been in place for a number of years. So I did flag that also. I thought, what are we talking about here? That's what that refers to. With respect to the chairman of education's, two of the concerns that I heard was that we do have agent source verification. The breed associations have that, and that's a marketing tool, and that's that does work, and it does provide for marketing opportunities that enhance the livestock producer. And that doesn't the Wyoming Business Council already have these types of? They do, and this, I guess I'll have to think about the added language of here of identification. Those are all identification programs. We really want to talk about a traceback program. I would submit to you that they have to be confined in a certain database at some place so that they can be retrieved, and that to me is the necessity of having a traceback program under one division, in this case with the Livestock Board. The RFID tags that my good member of the Ag Committee talked about, those are to replace the current brucellosis, what we call the orange bangs tags. And his concern is not unfounded. That's why the national program really kind of failed, because they could not trace them animals electronically at the speed of commerce. But those numbers on those RFID tags, when they are put in the place of what the orange bang tags, those numbers are sourced at that point, and that information is provided to the Livestock Board. So someplace down the road, if they need to trace that animal back, they don't have to do it necessarily electronically. They can do that based on the numbers that have been recorded when the veterinary puts those in. So I wasn't surprised we had some conversation about this. I guess I was a little surprised we had this amount, but that's the process. And if there are any further questions, I would call for the question.
Okay, question being called. All those in favor of Representative Semlich's motion that when committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 7 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
House Bill 7 is passed committee of the whole. Next up, the next bill for our consideration. Representative Gay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I have privilege of the floor, please? In the North Gallery, up here, we have the Wyoming Federation of Republican Women. My good friend Bonnie Foster from Casper is waving to us. Would you stand up, please?
Welcome to the House. Chairman Lockhart. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to also make the introduction of Ms. Bonnie Foster, but for a wholly different reason. She took charge of the funeral arrangements for Elaine Scott and was kind of the person that made that run smoothly, and I want to thank her for the job she did for one of our senators, wives, and the funeral arrangements that were necessary to be performed, and allowed Charlie to be down here with his outlet while that was all ramping up. So thank you very much, Bonnie. And
Okay, the next bill for
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I even wore red today and you still couldn't find me. I know you think there's just elementary students up there in the South Gallery, but there is someone very special to me, and he's been trying to hide for the last couple of days, but I'd like for all of you to give a good cheer out to Bob Berger, my husband.
Welcome, Bob. Representative Casper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege is for.
Proceed.
Also in the North Gallery are some good friends from Campbell County. So I'd like to introduce Michelle Rogers, Gail Cooper. They work at the District Court Office. And Mary Silvernell, who is, works at the Visitors and Tourism Bureau.
Welcome to the House. Representative Hunt.
Privilege of the floor.
Granted.
Thank you. As promised, we have more of Mr. Munger's class over here to your left. So let's give them a big welcome. And also behind you, my apologies.
Welcome to the House. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 95. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 95, introduced by Representative Patton, an act relating to education, student-to-teacher racial waiver. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bechtel, Burkhart, Connolly, Freeman, Croker, Crone, Laux, Madden, Teeters. Signed, Representative Teeters, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 95 do pass, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the sponsor from Sheridan.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill provides, as we spoke on the time of the introduction, to provide a waiver for the schools that have the highest academic performance schools as defined by the Wyoming Accountability to have a waiver granted to them on the 16-to-1 ratio. That ratio is provides for an exception, as you'll note on the bill on page 2, line 12, shall apply to charter schools, but it does make for a general provision, but it doesn't say that it shall. It says that it may. So this is, to me, a positive thing, so that if a school is slightly over the 16-to-1 ratio, it doesn't have to be criticized or penalized. In the interests of... I'll yield further discussion to
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, I think this really does codify in law the intention of the 16-to-1 ratio. When we passed it last year, we included language that said that high-performing schools should be exempt. At that point in time, we didn't have a measurement for what a high-performing school was. With the accountability bill that we're passing, or probably will pass through this body next week, it delineates what that high-performing school is, and it just brings it all back together. So I appreciate the sponsor.
Questions on the bill further? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Teeter's motion when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with the recommendation of Bill Number 95 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 95 is passed. Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 46. Chairman, reading clerk will read the bill, sorry.
House Bill 46, introduced by Representative Vronish, an act relating to handicap parking, space, size, and marking. This bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Bonner, Botten, Kennedy, McKim, Peterson, Korberg, Vronish, Swanitzer, Dave, signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman.
Put the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Corbett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 46 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill over to my good colleague from House District 49.
Representative Brandish.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This bill further defines that the handicapped parking area. So many times we all see the crosshatched area. When there is a crosshatched area next to a handicapped parking space, oftentimes someone will occupy that parking space that is not handicapped because they think it's a free space. Now, this further defines that that space is part of the handicapped parking space. And also, it does not require that that hatch marks be painted. It makes no, we're not making any change in the requirements for handicap parking in the state. And the amendment is a friendly amendment. What it does is it just further clarifies the definition of the crosshatched area. So,
you've heard the question, the motion on the amendment. Are you ready for the question on the amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee has adopted the standing committee amendment has number one has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there any
question?
All right, question on the bill. Question being, Representative Davis. I'm sorry, I didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add. This last week, I've had an opportunity to have a young lady that's been staying with us that's in a wheelchair with no legs. And I asked her about this bill, and she said this would help so much because so many times people think those cross marks are just another place, a little gives them a little more space. So when the handicap parks there, they don't have room to get their wheelchair out. So this is a very good bill. I believe that it is necessary. Thank you.
Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Korber's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 46 do pass, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. House Bill 46 is passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Would you move House Bill Number 119 down below House Bill 92? That's 9 bills down and 14 to go.
Not bad, huh? Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 76. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 76, introduced by Representative Petroff, an act relating to liquor licenses. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Eyes, Blickery, Bird, Illaway, Yegi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Nose, Wanasser, Dan, signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 76 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And the good lady from the Tall Mountains to the West, District 16, will discuss the bill.
The amendment also?
And the amendment.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it'll be easier and faster to explain the amendment within the context of the bill. First, I'd like to explain what a resort retail liquor license is and what it allows you to do. In order to qualify for a resort liquor license today, you need to have at least 100 sleeping units, a restaurant, a meeting room that can hold 100 people, and there needs to be at least $1 million, committed or expended on the facility, not including the land. So, one of the things that a resort liquor license allows you to do is to serve liquor throughout the entire property. And that's an important characteristic of that license as opposed to a regular retail license, which allows you to serve liquor within a specific building. You still have to pay for dispensing for the different locations, and that has been, in some cases, a great help for the counties. Until recently, this has worked for many of our ski areas because the ski areas that require this type of license or that use this type of license have had sleeping units within the ski, as part of their business. In today's more challenging economic times, several of them are facing needing to either sever from the lodging or just improve their financial condition by severing from the lodging. And we're certainly not in an era of building ski areas. Two of our state ski areas are currently closed. Two almost didn't open this year. And so we just need to give support to these kinds of businesses and allow them some flexibility. So they're marginal businesses, but they're major economic drivers in our communities. They support hotels, motels, restaurants, retail, bars. And in our effort to draft legislation, we wanted to try to make it as broad as possible. So we initially brought the bill saying recreation areas. And that caused some concern within the industry that it would open it up too broadly. And so the retail liquor industry came back to us and suggested that we do it for ski areas since that was our intention. So in looking through the current statutes, we realize that there's a lot of precedent for that. We currently allow an exception for golf courses, to allow golf courses to use a regular license to serve liquor throughout their entire golf course. We allow exceptions for guest ranches to be able to serve with a restaurant liquor license to be able to serve throughout their entire property. We have an exceptional license for the University of Wyoming. We have an exceptional licenses for social clubs. We'll be seeing a bill here in the next couple of weeks for a distillery. And so, you know, we have this complex set of regulations, and it requires us to make adjustments sometimes when the situations and environmental conditions change. So to explain the amendment, again, we're changing recreation to ski resort. And the other change in the amendment, which was recommended by one of the committee members, it was a good change. Earlier in the statute, when we're talking about the $1 million that's required currently for hotel owners, we phrase it as committed or expended on. And so we're changing invested to committed or expended on to make that language consistent and clear. So if there are no questions about the amendment, I would call for the question on amendment number one.
Question having been called, all those... excuse me, Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I have a question for either the chairman of the committee or the good representative. By taking out recreation, narrowing it down basically to the motels, hotels, and ski resorts, aren't you limiting it somewhat that... you know, while I can't think of any right now, but other recreation ventures from being able to get that liquor license. If you could call a recreation restaurant, I don't know.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, there's no recreation component to the resort liquor license, so we're adding that component. Now, the concern with changing it to recreation is that it might open it up to any type of recreation, to a swimming pool or to a roller skating rink or, you know, a bowling alley. And so since we're specifically talking about ski resorts in this case, and since we've already covered resorts like golf courses and so forth, we felt it was appropriate to limit it to ski areas.
Chairman Illoway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make note that you did get a handout from an association, and it does say why it narrowed it. And it says in the first paragraph something to the effect that a resort liquor license could have been stretched to include such things as swimming pools and so forth, and they felt the definition was probably too broad. So that's why it was narrowed, and it also says in the bill $10 million. So it's pretty narrow and pretty tight, and we think this is a good piece of legislation to help out those particular areas that do need it.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just have to go by my memory that a former legislator here, longtime legislator, very active in the community in the high mountains, she thought long and hard to finally come up with this and other resort issues. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, we're on the standing committee of men. Oh, Chairman Brown. Mr. Chairman, I still don't understand the amendment, and I think I'm against the amendment because if you look at the statute in 12.4.401, to qualify for a resort liquor license, the appropriate licensing authority shall require the resort complex to either have a value of $1 million, excluding the value of the land, include a restaurant and convention facility that will seat not less than 100 persons, or three, and now we're changing three, so three is what's in the bill, either a motel or hotel accommodations with a minimum of 100 sleeping rooms, or a recreation facility open to the general public in which the applicant shall have invested or committed or expended on the facility not less than $10 million. Now, I don't understand what the problem is. If there's a $10 million swimming pool out there, why shouldn't they have a resort liquor license, just for argument's sake? They're going to have, I don't think this is going to allow anybody to have a resort license unless they've either committed or expended on it not less than $10 million. So it may be that I'm thinking as I go here, but it may be that what I need to do is, no. I don't think I want to divide the amendment. I just am against the amendment. I think that a recreation facility that's got $10 million in it, I don't care if it is a swimming pool or a water park. If it's a $10 million facility, then it seems to me it's a major enough improvement that if they want to have a resort liquor license, they ought to be able to have it. So on and against the amendment. Chairman. Representative Patton?
Yeah. On and for the amendment, the committee worked with this and worked with the testimony of the Liquor Commission to try and make it palatable and acceptable and still have some control over what they were doing in the definition of the operations of the Liquor Commission. So to make it, to look at recreation and which was struck and put in the name of the ski resort, did exactly that, and the committee was quite responsive to it. As to the invested or the committed and expended upon, we're trying to make the Liquor Commission's statements for qualification having some kind of reasonable standard that is consistent within their purview, and that's exactly what it does and what the amendment is about. So I don't see belaboring it all that much. It seems to me that if you want to change the body of the thing, you can do so on second reading. Other than that, I support the amendment.
Chairman Illaway or Chairman McComey, are you? Oh, Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't like the specificity of a lot of these liquor requirements, but that's how we've drafted them in the past. Again, we have specific requirements for golf courses and so forth, and if this satisfies the concerns of the industry, seeing as we don't have other facilities that are looking for this type of thing yet, I think it's fine to define it as ski resort, and if we have to come back when someone wants to open a water park and relook at the statutes, we can do it at that time, so I encourage your aye vote on the amendment.
Chairman Childers, do you have a This question has been called. Do you have something to say? Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I still go back to the recreation, excuse me, ski resort, and I lost my train of thought what I was trying to think, a convention center, things like that. Admittedly, this is a small state, but more and more tourist-type businesses that show up that would fit the recreation category, I'm concerned that we're closing the door on that. We can always go back and change the law. I realize that, but I cannot agree with the ski resort, which I guess I'd have to disagree with the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, we're on the standing committee amendment number one. Are you ready for the question,
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I move to divide the amendment. Lines 1 through 3 would be Division 1. Lines 4 through 7 would be Division 2.
So is it divisible?
You have to rule on that, Mr. Chairman. If you want an opinion, I've got one.
Well, I'll find that it's divisible. Proceed, Chairman Brown.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have no problem with Division 2. On Division 1, you've heard my argument. I'd urge you to vote no on Division 1.
Okay, we have Division 1 of Amendment 1, and is there any debate or remarks on that? Chairman McComey.
Thank you. Well, I disagree with the good chairman from Judiciary. I think the bill was brought with the intent, with this as an intention, and I do believe that we need to be specific. And when we get done with the amendments, I have another question on the bill. But I support Division 1.
Representative Petroff?
Well, last comment to in regard to closing the door to other types of industries, we're not allowing this type of use now, so we're actually opening the door to the ski industry. We're just not opening the door wider at this time.
Okay, question's been called on Division 1. All in favor of Division 1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Division 1 has been adopted. Now we're on Division 2. Okay. Question's been called in Division 2. All those in favor of Division 1, say aye. Two, say aye. Opposed, no. Division 2 has been adopted. All right. Question's been called on Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on the bill. We've talked about ski resorts and struggling ski resorts and ski resorts closing. I question the amount of $10 million. We have several smaller ski areas in Wyoming that, I do not believe they're $10 million. I know it's expensive to do one, but I don't think it's that. So I'd like to get with the sponsor later on and look at some numbers and see if we could work something out for a second reading amendment.
Okay.
I support the bill.
Now we're ready for questions. Question's been called on the... Sorry. Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill... It seems to me that if you are a skier and you want to go skiing, that you should, and that the draw or the attraction of going should be the mountains, the snow, the exhilaration of going down the hill, all of those wonderful things that are connected with skiing. If we have to use liquor to entice people to go to enjoy those activities, then what are we setting ourselves up for? Are we going to be then passing drunk skiing laws? Are we then going to have to be concerned about people who've been imbibing? And we've seen accidents. We've seen accidents where people have been charged criminally with colliding with other skiers or ski boarding too fast. We've already seen that. And so if they're not going to be drinking while they are skiing or before they go skiing, then they're going to just enjoy a nice drink before they get on the highway and drive home. On and against the bill.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On in support of the bill as drafted. This is a very, very important industry to our state, and if we can enhance the locations that will stay in the business of providing skiing for folks like my wife and I, I'm all in favor of it, so I'd urge your support of the bill. And if there's some corrections I want to do it, let's do them on other times with second reading amendments and that kind of thing.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in favor of the bill. One of the problems with the way we have the current resort license bill is it creates weird incentives. And so you have a situation where you may have ski areas that have the hotel facilities and that sort of thing that qualify currently for the resort license. And maybe it makes economic sense and business planning sense to separate those operations. But you just by use of and by mandate of the liquor license, you're keeping them together when the economics don't – that decision economically doesn't make sense. So really, I mean, this just frees up those sorts of organizations to make economic sense that are driven by economics, not by how we've structured the liquor licenses. It's sort of like how we have two towns all over the place, and you can look back at how we distributed liquor licenses and see how we've, you know, and that cause effect. So this really just gives freedom to those sorts of resorts to do the business planning they need to do anyway. So I urge your aye vote.
Any further discussion? Question's been called. All those in favor of Representative Aylway's motion to when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 76 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill of 76 is passed to Committee of the House. Next bill, Committee of the Whole, Committee of the House. All right. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 113. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 113, introduced by Representative Bonner, an act relating to public health critical access endowment challenge program. This bill was referred to committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Kraft, Gay, Gingrich, Green, Harvey, Miller, Peasley, Reeder, signed Representative Harvey, Chairman.
Okay, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 113 do pass, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good sponsor from Park County.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The title of the bill, HB 113, is Critical Access Endowment Challenge Program. It ought to really be Critical Access Hospital Endowment Challenge Program, because that's what we're talking about. This is not your typical change of sunset bill, which extends a bill or extends a program simply by extending the sunset date. The primary intent is to provide more time to critical access and rural hospitals to take advantage of an endowment challenge program. But I've worked with the small hospital foundations to also draft a bill that recognizes reality. And this is the premise. Not all eligible hospitals are going to realize a full match. The state is better served to release some of the matching funds if they're not going to be utilized, and that's what HB 113 does. First, just a quick review for the body. The original appropriation back in 2007 was for $4 million. Each of the 16 critical access and rural hospitals in the state could match up to $250,000, dividing that $4 million equally. Only two have matched the full $250,000.
Now, this bill would do three things. It would extend the program for 2 more years without an additional appropriation, and that's 2 years beyond the June 30th, 2012 expiration date. It would downsize the program by reverting over $1 million on June 30th, 2012. And it would set up a pool of $1.5 million from the unobligated balance on June 30th, 2012. And those critical access hospitals that have not realized the full $250,000 match will be able to compete for funds for 2 more years or until the balance of the fund is zero. I said the program would revert over $1 million on June 30th, 2012. Here's the picture today. The fund holds a balance of $2.8 million. If we continue on in an extension of the program, $1.5 million, that's $1.3 million set to revert. But some of that money will be matched between now and June 30th. But we're going to be somewhere over $1 million. Originally, each hospital had its own account. On page 3 and 4 of this bill, we go through the procedures to separate accounts, to move the funds from the separate accounts and segregate out this pool of $1.5 million and then provide for the reversion on June 30th. Starting on July 1 of this year, the bill also revises how the match is paid to all critical access hospitals to set up a more uniform dollar-for-dollar match. And this is outlined in subsection K on page 6. And let me explain. As it relates to special district hospitals, for the most part, special district hospitals have only been able to match at 50 cents on the dollar. And county hospitals, on the other hand, have been able to match dollar for dollar. And the reason that special district hospitals have only been able to match 50 cents, and I understand this, the original bill set up some requirements to ask everybody to do their part. And they inserted a provision that if special district hospitals did not match or did not levy the full available 3 mil maximum, they couldn't participate, but even if they did, they would only get 50 cents on the dollar if they did not do this additional step, go beyond the 3 mil maximum levy, and also ask the voters of the hospital district to, in an election, to approve a mil levy beyond 3 mils. And for the most part, hospital districts haven't done that. They've gone with they're levying the 3 mils, so consequently they're only getting a 50% match. We've had several hospitals that have matched over $125,000, over the $250,000, but they have only been able to realize 50 cents on the dollar, so they're still back in the $125,000 range. I maintain that it's a little bit of an unfair situation to those hospital district hospitals. They have had maximum taxing effort, and yet they haven't gone beyond to ask for additional levy. And let me tell you what it would be in the hospital district that I know about. $100 million valuation in the district, 1 mil levy would raise $1 million. So we're asking that hospital district to tax their taxpayers another $1 million to qualify for a $125,000 match. This change in statute at this moment would put everybody in a dollar-for-dollar match. County hospitals, by the way, they get their money out of a 12-mil general county levy. County hospital, and I've talked to some of the county commissioners and counties that have done very well with this program, they might levy 1.5 mils or 2 mils is all for the hospital operation, depending on what the particular needs is in a given year. So county hospitals and the people have been able to qualify for a dollar of match with a levy of perhaps less than 3 mils. Special district hospitals have to levy on their taxpayers a full 3 mils and go beyond in a special hospital district election to qualify for a dollar. So I think this change just sets up a more uniform matching situation.
Any discussion? Chairman,
I would stand for questions.
Well, thank you. This just gives me an opportunity. I support the bill and what it is, but we have now, I believe, 3 private hospitals in Wyoming run by private full corporations where the taxpayers aren't having to pay any mills, and they can't qualify for this.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Harvey's motion and when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 113 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Or aye. Yeah. House Bill 113 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 65. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 65, introduced by Representative Stephenson, an act relating to banks and banking, banks authorized investments. This bill was sent to the Corporation Committee, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dan. No, Bird, Patton, signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 65, do pass. There are no amendments, and I would allow the bringer of the bill from House District 56 to talk about the bill.
Representative Stubson, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I gave a little foreshadowing during introduction, this change is really to put state chartered banks on an equal footing with nationally chartered banks and to correct a sort of quirk in the statute that prevents investments by banks that really would be beneficial to both banks and their depositors. And what this impacts is banks invest their deposits. And those are highly regulated in what they can invest in. The banks, when they are examined, it's ensured that their investments are in secure investment vehicles. But there are a list of bonds that are issued by essentially what are government-sponsored entities. And these are things like the Federal Home Loan Bank, Student Loan Marketing Association, the Federal Farm Credit Bank, all these sorts of government entities or government-guaranteed entities, and they issue bonds. And state-chartered banks can invest their deposits directly in those bonds. And they can also invest these deposits in mutual funds that contain treasuries, but they can't invest in mutual funds that contain both. And so it's a little quirk, but there are some mutual funds out there that have pretty, in today's market at least, pretty decent rates of return that state banks just can't put their deposits in, but the bank right across the street that may be federally chartered can put their deposits in. So this just puts those banks on equal footing. We had testimony from the regulators that you're comfortable with this. They don't believe that this really expands any sort of risk for folks that use state chartered banks. And a couple things to point out. First, these mutual funds, it actually increases their security in some respects because they're highly liquid. And so it actually can help the liquidity of banks when they invest in these rather than directly in the bonds themselves. So that's a plus that we don't get for state chartered banks as the law is right now. The second thing is that banks are still required to exercise their due diligence on their investments, and the whole bank review process still occurs. I mean, this doesn't open the door at all. It just creates the ability to invest in collectively and in a more liquid form what banks can already invest in. And so with that, I would take any questions that the body may have on the bill.
Okay, any discussion on the bill?
Question being called. Representative Patton.
I just want to take one moment to explain what happened in the committee and why I voted no. The bank laws in the past provided a provision that said that unconditionally guaranteed by the United States were mutual funds were prohibited as an investment. And you can do with this as you wish. If you feel that the due diligence of your banks is great enough that they understand, that that's fine and dandy. However, please understand that the difference between the mutual fund holding only federal securities does not have the privilege then of stating that its price at the time of the sale is guaranteed. There cannot be a guarantee from a mutual fund. You paid $10 per share for the mutual fund, and at the time that you sell it, that $10 can change. Not only can change, but must change at the close of business every day. Thus, the price of the fund is inversely related to the interest rate. Inversely related. Interest rates go up, the price goes down. So that is a part of the risk. I just want you to understand what that risk is, and if you feel comfortable with that, fine and dandy, go ahead and vote.
Any discussion? Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, that's no different than a bank investing in bonds. The same inverse relationship exists, and bonds are capable of doing that right now. And on in favor of the bill.
Any further discussion? Question being called, all those in favor of Representative Illaway's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that bill number 65 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House bill 65 is passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is House bill 48. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 48, introduced by Representative Ludlow, an act relating to speed limits, 80 miles per hour speed limit. This bill is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Kennedy, McKim, Peterson, Korberg, Ronish, Zwanitzer, Dave, excused, Blake, signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Korberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 48 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill over to the good Majority Floor Leader.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, House Bill 48, the 80-mile-an-hour speed limit bill, came to me as a result of a constituent call. And my constituent was driving to a gambling mecca in a different state. And as he was driving through the Beehive State, he noticed he could drive 80 miles an hour and asked, well, why can you drive 80 miles an hour in the interstates in Utah and you can't in Wyoming? I did some research and found out that there is no impact on the federal funds. I did some further research, and you've got all of the research in front of you, that in Texas, as we talked about in bill introduction, fatalities actually decreased on those stretches of highway where the speed limit was increased to 80. Wyoming had similar experience when they increased the speed limits from 55 to 75 back in the day. I've also included with you a Utah study. The Utah study shows that when they increased the speed limit to 80 miles an hour on the highways, everybody was driving 82 miles an hour anyway, and the speeds didn't change one whit between the time before and the time after that changed the speed limit. It was actually about a tenth of a percent for the 85th percentile speeds. What they also found in the study was there were a decrease in the number of vehicles exceeding the posted speed limit once the speed was increased to 80 miles an hour. Now, YDOT, you'll see in the back, doesn't think that that's exactly the case. YDOT reports that this is a possible program, but And they have, in the Standing Committee Amendment, asked for this to be on interstate highways only. And so I would urge your adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment to make it on interstate highways only. But it's not everywhere on interstate highways. It's not a blanket raising the speed limit to 80 miles an hour. What it does is it allows, after an engineering study and following engineering and design standards for that, for the state superintendent, the person who's the son of a member of this body, to make the determination whether to increase or lower the speed limits. And you'll know on that big highway we have going across the southern part of the state that they have variable speed limit signs. And those variable speed limit signs are two types. One are LED displays and the other are big drums. And if they do it where the drums are, they have to replace some of the drums because they only go to 75 and you need to add another sheet of paper in there to make it go to 80. For the electronic signs, they can go all the way from 5 miles an hour, from 1 mile an hour to 99 miles an hour on the variable speed limit signs. So not all areas would have that speed limit. It'd have to be due to design standards. There would have to be some additional curve warning signs. If they did it all at once, they think that there's an appropriation of $250,000. This bill doesn't have an appropriation. My recommendation was if you don't have the money to do it, don't do it. It's within your discretion. There may be some potential increase in the cost of future reconstruction if they wanted to design for higher speeds. WIDOT believed that that was possible. If you look at the bill, the operative section is 315302, where it allows the superintendent to increase to a maximum speed limit of 80 miles an hour. If you read that statute and you read it closely, Wyoming doesn't have any maximum speed limit. They just set a presumptive speed limit at 75 miles an hour on the interstate and then allow the superintendent to decrease it. The superintendent zones, and it's kind of interesting, those signs, the electronic signs, they have cameras and speed detectors in them so they know what the traffic's going. So if the traffic's driving too fast, they can slow it down from a control center in Cheyenne. So if the superintendent determines due to traffic, road conditions and weather conditions that the speed limit can go to 80, then the superintendent has the discretion to do that, and that would be what the purpose of this bill is. I'd stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
We need to vote on the Standing Committee Amendment. Okay, question been called on the Standing Committee Amendment. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. All right. Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Korberg's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 48 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 48 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the House stand in recess until 1 p.m.
Thank you. I did want to enter into that debate a little bit because the Majority Floor Leader was talking about some statistics and St. Peter. Oh, all right. Okay. Chairman, committee announcements.
Are you talking to me?
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet 10 minutes upon adjournment in room H17 to consider the following bills. Senate File 32, Engrossed, Workers' Compensation Amendment. Committee members, please bring the blue copy off your desk.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, we'll meet Monday at noon recess. We'll talk about Senate File 5, Engrossed, County Commissioners, Removal of Appointed Board Members, Senate File 6, County Memorial Hospital Districts, Senate File 7, Election Districts Revisions, and Senate File 62, Engrossed, Electrical Installation Licensing Exceptions.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your committee number 9, Minerals Business and Economic Development, will meet at 8 o'clock in room H18. To consider Senate File 45, Alcoholic Beverages Manufacturing. There will be a breath test at the meeting.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
proceed.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you are hungry, the Wyoming Arts Alliance is having their Arts Advocacy Day luncheon in the west atrium of the Hirschler Building, and you are all invited to go have a bite to eat and visit with them about the arts.
Right, set. One. Okay. For any further announcements? All right, Committee of the Whole will rise and set again at 1 o'clock.